On this episode of Still Loading, have you played Atari today? Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval, and today on the show, we are diving back into an era of gaming history that I don't cover as much as I probably should, considering it was such a formative part of gaming history in general. We are going to be talking a little bit about Atari today. If you couldn't tell by the tagline, I guess that was a little on the nose, and plus the title of the episode. But with me today is the creator of the Atari Archive YouTube channel, Kevin Bunch. Kevin, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming on the show. I've wanted to have you on for a little bit now. I told you off mic, I've followed your work on through Retronauts and discovered your work through Retronauts and the Video Game History Hour podcasts. And I've watched a couple of your videos on YouTube, and I really like what you do. And I wanted to have you on because, like I said, this is a era of gaming that's really kind of underrepresented on YouTube. I feel like most YouTube content is so NES focused and up, and then maybe after that Sega, and then Atari is always on the bottom usually of it, just because I, at least in my personal opinion, while I the games don't always hold up for me enough for me to find as much fun playing them, but that doesn't take away from the fact of their importance or the fact that there's some of them that are still legitimately fun. But that's why I feel like that may not be focused on as much as it should, but that doesn't change the fact that it needs to be focused on. So that's why I love your channel, because and I also love that you don't stick to just the games. You start with the game as the beginning point, and then you find ways to bring in other interesting aspects of Atari's history and game history into each game discussion. I always found that from the very first video you were doing that, I really enjoy your work with that. So to start this off, though, question you probably get a bunch, but I feel like it'd be interesting to my listeners: what was your inspiration for the channel? What kind of inspired you to start this journey of chronicling everything Atari?
Oh, geez. So that, I feel like I initially got the idea percolating in my head almost, 8 years ago now, which, you know, I've been doing the channel for 5 years, so it took a little bit of time between me getting the idea and actually doing it. But, at the time, I'd been watching some of what Jeremy Parrish had been doing with Game Boy and his chronological series there, and I'd seen, Crontendo, where he was going through all of the Famicom and NES games. And I thought, that would be really cool to do with Atari, because no one really cares that much about Atari. Like, people care about Atari, but, it's not a heavy topic for that particular venue and that particular approach. So first I had to figure out, okay, what order did these things even come out in? Because at the time, this was not information that was readily available, so that took a few years to finally put together. And by that point, I sort of had in my head, like, okay, well, a lot of the topics related to these games are just, they're never gonna get talked about or covered on a YouTube series. Like, no one's digging into mainframe computer games versions of baseball or whatever, so this is my opportunity to sort of shed a little bit of light on those two. And it's kind of kept rolling. I'm still having fun with it, so I guess I can keep doing it.
Well, that's the most important part. Like, if it's not fun, why do it at all then at that point, especially for something that it can't really make a living off of just yet? Am I right? Is this more of a passion project than anything?
Yeah, this is a bit of a passion project. Like, I do have a Patreon and it does make a little bit of money, but it's not a huge amount of money. But it's enough to make me feel like okay, well, sure, I'm spending, X amount of hours, for video, trawling around old documents or whatever. But, at least my my time doesn't feel like I've blown it doing nothing. I would probably still be doing this anyway, even if I wasn't making any money off it, but
I've been talking about this with some of the other content creators I've had on the show recently. It's that weird dichotomy, or not, maybe not dichotomy, but that weird symbiotic relationship with the audience, where it's like you would probably have done this or still be doing this if it, like, without, with or without the audience. But when you add the audience into it, it kind of gives you that extra drive, like, oh man, I'm doing this for more than just myself now. Like it's that feeling of like I'm entertaining other people and educating other people. I don't consider myself that educational, more of an edutainment as the closest thing is the most generous I could give myself. But I understand that kind of, like, it's weird. That balance is very strange, where it's like, you do this for the love of it, but you also do this because having someone that appreciate your work really drives you, you know, it really pushes.
I probably, like, I've tried to aim to have at least one thing out a month. And if I didn't have much of an audience, I probably would not even do it that consistently.
I can understand. I think it affects the frequency more than anything. It's like, well, I don't have as, like, I turn the podcast weekly for the same reason. Like, once you have an audience, like, oh, I gotta, like, it's fun. It's more fun now knowing that it's like making the people are noticing type of thing. Mm-hmm. So that was the inspiration for your channel, but what got you interest in video game history overall? Where was the spark for that? Like, what got you into it?
Oh, well, that you'd have to go back even earlier. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I was a kid, we had an Atari growing up, and then we got a 7800, and, you know, then an NES. So, like, you know, old video games were around. I mean, I guess the NES wasn't that old at the time. It was contemporary, but either way, you know, mm-hmm. I was used to playing Atari games, and I remember around, what, 92 93, I was like 9 or 10, but you know, the library was near where we lived, and I used to stop in there all the time, and they had a copy of a book called The Winner's Book of Video Games. It was by Craig Cuby, came out in 1982. And, you know, part of it is that it's a strategy guide for, like, you know, the then current games. But also he, like, talks a fair bit about, you know, the culture of the games at the time and their creation. Oh. And he talked about some of the older games that you could still find around here and there at the time, but were not very common. And I remember reading that and thinking, wow, there's a lot more, like, cool aspects to this than I even thought about, because, you know, I was years removed from anyone caring about arcade machines, and my parents didn't let me go to the arcade that often because they figured we spent this money on games at home. Why do we have mm-hmm. to give you a roll of quarters to go play there? So, you know, that sort of stuck with me for a while, and you got older, and the internet became more of a thing, and started following, you know, people who were doing, you know, game collecting, but also game history. And eventually I just got to a point where I thought, well, maybe I could do this too.
Did you ever interview the author of that book, or did you ever reach out to him afterwards? Like, the guy that kind of sparked your interest in game history?
I actually haven't. I know someone who did, and I told him, like, oh, can you tell him this for me? And apparently he got a kick out of it, but I have not talked to him personally.
You should get on that then. No,
it'd be funny.
That's really cool though. That's crazy to think there was a book that existed that early. In the video game industry was in its nascent stages. You know, like, it was barely a thing at that. That's crazy. That's kind of interesting. That reminds me of, what's that book? Phoenix, right? Not Phoenix,
the one,
right?
By
not
the... Leonard Herman, or
yeah, that's the one, because that came out in, like, what, the 90s, the first edition of it.
Yeah, I think so. That thing is a chonker. It's huge.
I still have never. I need to get my hands on it, because it's one of the earliest examples of writing in game history, and that's why I was just so fascinated when you said 1982. I'm like, really? Like, something that early? I understand it wasn't dedicated to game history, but still, it's cool that there was something that at least was along the lines of that.
It's There's another one from that general time frame called Zap, which is I think it came out around the time that the market kind of imploded. And that's sort of about Atari specifically and their rise and their free fall after that. I'm pretty sure I've read that at some point. I don't remember if I have recently. I don't own a copy, so. But I know that that was also a formative work.
Actually, this is just thinking of the rise and fall of Atari. This is going to be a dumb question that I'm pretty sure you know the answer to. Actually, I'm 99% certain you know the answer to. What year was Atari sold to Warner? Because I always get confused the timeline of Atari being created, then getting sold to Warner, and then the crash happened. Like, how soon after the sale did the crash happen in 83?
So the Atari sold it to Warner in 1976.
Really? Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Warner basically bankrolled the 2600, the VCS's development, which was good because, say what you will about Nolan Bushnell as Atari's president, but they had a lot of boom and bust cycles when they were independent, and Warner gave them a lot of stability that they needed. I don't remember if I got into it in the video, but I know I've talked about it. I should say I also put together an Atari Archive book that's coming out in January of the first couple of years of the VCS in its library. And I know for part of that, I wrote about how, when they produced Grand Track 10 in, I think, 1974, it was like an early racing game. It's done a whole lot of really cool stuff. But it also cost them a boatload of money, and they ended up the year in like $600,000 in the red, and they ended up having to sell off their Japanese division and tighten their belt all over the place. It was a mess, and the game was a success. That was my favorite part, is that it was a big hit, but it was so costly to make that it cost them a ton of money. So yeah, Atari had issues, and then Warner came along and just sort of helped to lighten that part of the load.
Then how long was Bushnell in charge of Atari? Was it up until the acquisition, or was it like after the acquisition he still stayed on in a leading role?
Yeah, he continued to lead Atari until the end of 1978, where he basically got pushed out because they had not a great year as far as console sales went. I think that was a big part of it. They overproduced the VCS systems, and the console market in general in 78 was just kind of weak. So they did not sell through, and they kept a profit, but it wasn't very big compared to what they got in 77. So he was the one who had to fall on his sword. And that's when Ray Kassar was put in charge by Warner, and he sort of led Atari through its golden years and also partway into it having a lot of issues.
Okay. Thank you for clearing that up for me. It's one of those things where like I've heard about it on so many different podcasts, but never really kind of, maybe it was laid out on some podcasts and I just wasn't paying enough close enough attention. A lot of times I listen while I'm at work, so sometimes I can't be 100% focused as much as I would like to.
That's one of those things with this era that I find interesting, is that there is a lot of like half remembered stories and misinformation floating around. So it's one of those things that I enjoy taking the opportunity to try and clear up some of these things and try to bring receipts as to how I reached my conclusions.
And I'm glad for it. And actually, it's perfect timing. I legitimately did not know you were having a book coming out in January. So this is kind of perfect timing, because this will be out in late October or early November. So just a month or so before your book drops. That's awesome.
It's early next year, but I don't know specifically the timing. Like, it just went to production last week, so I don't know how long the print time and ship times are, but should be a few months.
Were they already open for pre-orders, or will they go open for pre-orders at some point?
I think they'll go open for orders when they start getting them sometime in hand. I'm not sure. It's through the limited run games book imprint. So
okay, yeah,
selling
yeah.
them on Amazon, on their own website, etc.
I will probably have to pick up a copy then. I actually picked up Jeremy Parrish's Virtual Boy book, so I'll have to pick this up to add to my game, my section of my game room on video game history, all the books that I've started to read and not finished quite, but I'll have to finish yours.
Yeah,
I've started so many.
Where I had all of this information from these videos, I'm like, okay, well, I can just expand on this. This is my opportunity to do a second revision for all of these, based on all these resources I'd come across since I did the video. So it's definitely much expanded if you'd already seen the video.
I'm looking forward to it then. And actually, in speaking about your channel and your videos, I was going to ask, because a lot of your videos, you focus on individual games, and some of them are more broader topics, but a lot of them are the specific games. I was going to ask, were there any games that surprised you, both in a good or bad way? Was there a game that you were expecting was going to be better than it actually was, and you're disappointed with that? Or was there a game that you were expecting to be crap and it actually turned out to be pretty good?
So my go-to on this would probably be Activision's Bridge, because I don't play Bridge. I don't really, well, going into it, I didn't really know how to play Bridge, and I guess I only kind of remember the rules at this point, but, you know, I just remember thinking, well, geez, this is going to be a mess of a game, right? But no, it's actually, it's actually pretty playable. Once you kind of know what you're doing in Bridge, it's fairly fun. And I got to really find some interesting things out about its development history and how it did on the market. Like, you know, I remember digging up some newspaper reporting where someone from Activision talked about how, yeah, Bridge was like a minor seller, but it did really well among this specific demographic and really well in the northeast of the U.S. And, you know, usually you just hear about it and you're like, oh, yeah, it's some crummy game they put out and no one really cared too much about it. But no, actually, it had an audience and it found said audience. And the other one that really stuck out at me was Superman, because I hadn't really spent a lot of time with that game prior to that video, and it's sort of the cousin to Adventure, both in its development history, because they both came out of the same prototype that Warren Robinette had put together, but it does...
Oh, okay.
But it sort of, like, specializes in things that Adventure doesn't do very well, and vice versa. So, like, Superman's a very graphically interesting game, because, you know, the guy who wrote it, John Dunn, was an artist first and foremost. It does have like the multi-screen sort of thing going, like Adventure, but in this game, like, there's in-game storytelling. Like, you start off as Clark Kent going to work and you go over a screen and there's Lex Luthor blowing up a bridge and now you have to go back and, like, change into Superman in his phone booth and go after him and his goons and fix the bridge. And then you go to work and that's how you win the game. And it just does a lot of really interesting things like that. Just very early in-game storytelling and an early example of a game where you really can't lose. Cause I mean, you're Superman. No one can really hurt you that bad. So it's like a time-based game. It's a speed run game. Quite literally, that's how you track scores, how quickly you finish it. So it's just a really interesting piece of software that I hadn't really given much thought to, because it's a licensed game. You know, those have a reputation, but it's an extremely good licensed game.
I think I actually did watch your video on this one, too. I remember you talking about it and you were really impressed with it. Because, like you said, you go into different buildings, right? Or is it just the phone booth in the building?
There's like a subway. You can take that to like go to different parts of the city. And then you can walk around and fly around on this weird map that doesn't really line up like you'd think a real mid-city map would. But
I mean, they worked with what they got.
Yeah.
I'm always impressed when game devs take hardware that should not be able to do the things that like to me, that sounds, it's not quite open world, but it kind of is a bit. Like, it's from the way you describe it, you're exploring a city and going into different buildings, but it's, you know, you take the Superman has to take the subway to get the to get to the different areas of the city. Can't fly, but he can take the subway.
He can fly too. It's just it can be quicker to take the subway, which is just a very funny mental image to me of just someone on their commute and there's Superman just like hunched over in one of the little seats. Like, oh, this is my stop. Gotta go find a piece of a bridge. My favorite revelation of that is I had to find an old interview with John Dunn because he'd passed away a few years prior to me doing the video, and there someone had done an interview with him, and the website was no longer online, but it was on the Wayback Machine. So I was able to find that, and they actually asked him if there was anything he would have that he wanted to add to the game that he didn't have time, and he said he really wanted to have a co-op mode where the second player was Lois Lane, and he couldn't figure out how to implement that in the time constraints that he had to work with, because, you know, Warner wanted something out because Superman the movie was the hot thing at the time, and they really wanted a game out to, you know, go with their Superman merchandising push. So he had to just finish it and ship it. But I do have a lot of thoughts. I'm like, what would that have looked like? Like, how would you do a co-op game? Like an asymmetrical co-op game on a 1979 Atari game.
I'm just picturing, like, how would it be fun for the other player to be Lois in that situation? Where the one player gets to be this invulnerable monstrosity of a alien, and the other person's just a generic human, just a normal NPC.
But, you know, she's a journalist, so she's got questions. Yeah, I have no idea. I have no idea how it would have worked, but it would have been cool.
I wonder what one of the earliest examples of AI in a video game is, like an NPC AI.
It depends. Are we talking just like an enemy character or a player character? Or not a player character?
Let's just say, like, because I feel like AI would have come before the idea of an NPC, right? Because it's like the AI, I mean, I guess they technically are the same. I'm thinking of like an NPC that, I guess, I mean, an NPC is just any non-playable character. So literally NPCs have existed from, like, I mean, technically the aliens and like space invaders are NPCs, technically. I'm thinking more of like an RPG sense. Like, I wonder when, where it's, you know, you're just walking into a town and you go to some random poor schmo's house and you're just taking open all their treasure chests and they're just totally fine with it. I was thinking it more along those lines, but like I guess technically NPCs have been used.
Well,
that would be an interesting thing to see, the evolution of the NPC.
I am not sure. Like, I'm gonna guess it's something that was on a microcomputer or Play-Doh or something.
Probably. Yeah. Oh, Play-Doh. I should do a mini episode on Play-Doh. I don't know enough about it to do a full episode, but Play-Doh is... Have you studied the Play-Doh computer system at all?
Not deeply. But I know a little bit about it. I know just enough to be dangerous and spread
misinfo. Well, you know more than I do, but I just... spread misinformation. I should do so every now and then I do mini episodes on my Patreon for topics where I don't think I could devote a full episode to something, not unless I had like someone who was an actual expert on it. Just something where it's like, here's like your Cliff Notes style episodes of like specific niches in game history. Like, I did an episode a month or two ago on play by mail games, which I hadn't heard of existing before, up until like literally 2 months ago, where it blew my mind, the idea that you would physically mail in a letter for them to punch that move into a computer and then it would mail the results back out to the players. It was just the coolest but craziest thing I'd ever heard of. So maybe I'll have to do an episode on the Play-Doh at some point.
I just actually interviewed someone last week about the Dartmouth time sharing system, which was another early computer system at Dartmouth, college up in New Hampshire. And that's actually where they developed the original version of BASIC, like the computer language.
Okay.
And that was used a lot on the DTSS. And the person I talked to He didn't develop BASIC, and he wasn't like a computer tech person. He was a physicist, so he like used computers, but you know, and he knew programming languages. But he went there and he experienced BASIC for the first time, the time sharing system, and he just it blew his mind. He became sort of an evangelist for computers and computer programming, and he made a few games and encouraged his students to like work with it and try to make their own stuff. So that was a very interesting conversation. Some of those early like computer stories I'd love to delve into more, but I don't know that you can really do a video on those just because very little of the actual programming survives and or is emulated even. But it's a really interesting topic.
When did you start branching out away from Atari? Like it's still like I know your focus is still Atari, but you've had other videos on different aspects of game history that kind of all take place in this general like mid to late 70s, early 80s era. Like when did you start branching out from that, and what have been some of the other topics you've covered outside of Atari?
So it's fairly early that I started researching the history of RCA and video games. I had an interest in that. And I remember I was talking with a friend of mine on the phone one day while I was walking my dogs. And I was and we were talking about the video series that I had just started at that point. And I was thinking like, yeah, you know, this stuff's really interesting and it's really hard to find resources like this. Like I couldn't tell you much about the history of RCA and their video games. And I thought, and I'm like, well, on the other hand, what is out there? So I started poking around, and it turns out there are two like museum archive locations that have a bunch of documentation and artifacts from RCA's time working on computers and video games. So
were they curated by RCA?
So originally these were all part of like the Sarnoff library or Sarnoff Labs library, I think. And then they spun them all out to the College of New Jersey, which kept all the physical artifacts. Well, most of the physical artifacts. And they in turn sent all the documentation and like photo negatives and all that fun stuff to the Hagley Museum and Library in Delaware. And that's where the real treasure trove is, let me tell you, because, you know, not only do you have just boxes and boxes of internal documentation and memos on the development of this stuff, but, you know, we found a bunch of data tapes that had like earlier versions of the games that came out and a bunch of games that never actually saw a commercial release, like for earlier versions of the hardware, like the five known arcade games that RCA did in 1975. Those were there and up in TCNJ.
Wow.
Like a couple dozen, like two or three dozen, I'd have to double check the exact number, computer programs that they developed for their prototype computer hardware in the early 70s called Fred. So those were all accounted for. So that was really cool. I got to help them with their effort in digitizing those and trying to get those back into a playable state. And yeah, you can run all those on an emulator now. So it's really fun. But now, as it turns out, we have a very good understanding of RCA's history with all this stuff. and this inspired me to do a video about the research I'd done up to that point. And that was pretty early on. I want to say that was like within a year of me starting the channel. And since then, I've done a video on the Channel F, a second one on RCA as well, and I've got one video on the Intellivision under my belt. I'm currently starting work on a second one as of this recording, and there's one I really want to do on the Bally Professional Arcade game console. And I have so much information on that. It's just at this point, I'm looking at it and thinking, how the hell am I going to organize all this? Is this going to have to be two videos? Can I do it in one and just have it be extra long? Like, how do I want to handle this? And my response to that has just been to push it off. But But yeah, all of these things are really interesting to me because, like, I think the best description of it was when I was talking with one of the folks at Hagley, because they eventually gave me a grant to do research there and spend time to actually go through their documents without having to, you know, run back and forth from my house. But their guy over there said, like, oh, you know, everyone knows the success stories like Apple and Atari and all that. But the ones that didn't make it, they're really interesting, too, for different reasons. And I thought, like, yeah, you're right. So, and it turns out he was on the money. The history of the Bally console is ridiculously interesting and very unique. And super excited to tell that story, like the Channel F. Very underappreciated nowadays, and you know what it did and how it worked on the market and why it wasn't a success. Mm-hmm. So it's been really good to sort of shed light on that. Like, oh no, the system did fine. It's just the company was in shambles.
Interesting. What would you say has been one of the most pleasantly surprising, I don't want to say discoveries, but like maybe consoles or like rabbit holes you've jump down it. Would you say the RCA one, or do you have another one that comes to mind?
RCA would be a good one, but for me, it's the Bally Arcade's user-generated program rabbit hole. Because, you know, the Bally console had, I don't know, 24 cartridges that mm-hmm. came out officially, and then there's probably like 400 or 500 like art and game programs that enthusiasts programmed for it using the basic cartridges for it and like saved on cassette tapes and sold to each other or like they sold type-in listings or printed type-in listings in newsletters or whatever. And this was like a whole ecosystem that outlived the console by a few years. And I one of my favorite things to do in these videos is just bring up like, oh, this is what someone did on the Bally Arcade cartridge or the basic cartridge and sold on a cassette tape. So, you know, it's not as pretty as what, you know, something you'd see on the Atari. Maybe it doesn't run as smoothly, but this was something that was out there for people who have this console. And I think that's really cool. I was actually trying to convince a friend of mine that we should start up a podcast just going into user generated games like that, and it's sort of, you know, hit a wall because we don't have time, but it's just really fascinating stuff that like I never really gave much thought to until I started fussing around with the Bally.
I think one of the most fun things to discover, and I guess it just depended on the person, is when you discover an ecosystem for something that you never even heard of before. It's not just the fact that, you know, you had never heard of this console or this system or this type of computer line or something like that. It's that there's an entire ecosystem. It's this entire other world that was just completely, I mean, at least to the person discovering it, is just unknown. I mean, I think that's why like stuff like the Pluto fascinated me so much, and the way you're describing the Bally system, really, that's fascinating. It still blows my mind they put games on cassette tapes and like videotapes as well in other consoles. But and actually kind of like talking about all this stuff that we find interesting, that leads me to my next question is, what do you think, on your personal opinion, what makes this era of game history stand out compared to the rest? Like we've talked before about the NES and the Super Nintendo and Sega stuff, and then you get the PlayStation, all that stuff. It's really the stuff that's really focused in on. And there, you know, there's some elements that are not that still get stand out, like the Lucasfilm adventure games get a lot of look into, which for good reason, they're all fantastic, but like to you, what makes this era of video game history stand out compared to the rest?
Well, initially for me, because you know I grew up with the NES and all that fun stuff, initially for me it felt as though this was sort of a separate era that, you know, how much influence did it really have down the line? And as it turned out, had a great deal of influence, because a lot of the people who started developing on these consoles, like, they didn't stop when the market collapsed. Like, some of them kept going for a while on there. A lot of them moved to, you know, the ColecoVision for a bit, and then computers, and then, you know, eventually back to consoles. And, you know, a lot of them stuck around in the industry. You look at companies from the 90s like Accolade or 3DO, they had a lot of former Atari people working at them. And in the, if you look at the arcade space, like the US arcade space, even now is still made up of the people who were working, you know, back then on a lot of this stuff. So there is that sort of, this is, so how do I want to put this? This is really a primordial period, and it's not the video game industry as we think of it nowadays. It was kind of its own interesting very beast. Much so. And I think that's really fascinating, just to see how that eventually led into what we have today. I also find it very interesting that the more I dig up about the history at the time, like through contemporary reporting and trade magazines and newsletters and whatnot, how much more rich it is than you'd expect. Like, there's coverage of all these companies. Just, okay, my favorite anecdote from the late 70s is after the Supreme Court struck down the FCC's ability to charge people like an exorbitant amount of money to test their products to make sure they met their RF emissions. Like, they weren't charging anybody. So a bunch of companies, like, I want to say at least over 100, just started using them as a free test lab for their products. Just send them what they got. And when it failed, the FCC would tell them why it failed. And we're like, all right, thank you. We'll just fix that ourselves, and we won't have to pay someone for lab space. And I'm like, that is absurd. But it's right here in this, is it's right here on this yellow paper in, you know, typeset. And, like, this is not information that you know, gets out there that often. So, okay, cool. So it's just, like, it's really fascinating. There's just so many weird little anecdotes like that. Or, you know, the ad campaigns they had planned, and they'd advertise them in, like, retailer magazines. It's just very interesting to me, the weird twists and turns and rabbit holes all this goes down.
I think what really captivates me about this era, I did another mini episode on my Patreon about this, and once again, a Cliff Notes version of what should be, what could be a much more in-depth look into the, into this idea of, I called it the Wild West, not just because of, I mean, always, people always say that when there was a lot less rules in a specific industry, but what blows my mind about this era is that the big three at the time, Atari, Coleco, and Intellivision, or Mattel's Intellivision, all would have their own separate unit divisions that would publish games on the competitors' consoles. Which is just the weirdest. I don't understand their logic behind that. But at the same time, if software sells better than the hardware, it's just another ad revenue, another revenue stream. I don't know. But what's the name of it? There's, I forget which division it was. They're called the Blue something.
The Blue Sky Rangers.
The Blue Sky Rangers. I forget what did they what company were they from, and who did they publish for? Well, they published for
Mattel. Like, that was Mattel Electronics as a like a video game software division. So they did stuff for you know, the Intellivision, obviously, but they also programmed games for the 2600, because, you know, Atari had somewhere north of 70% of the console market. So if you wanted to make money, you'd be stupid not to publish on their system, even if you had your own. I was going to say, I actually dug up a really fun ad in you know, merchandising, which is the, you know, retailer focused trade magazine, and it's where the Mattel announces that they're making games for the 2600 now, and it's actually a very striking ad. I only found it on a microfilm, so it's not in color, but it still comes through really, really well in black and white. And my understanding is it's super weird. And my understanding is Coleco was sort of the same thing. Like, we have the rights to Donkey Kong. We're going to make a mint off of this. Let's put it on everything we can.
Smart way to do it, I guess. Now, out of all of the research that you've done through all this, do you have any, who has been some of your, I'm not going to ask you to say your least favorite, of course, but who has been some of the favorite people you've interviewed?
Oh, geez. I think my favorite ones, it was Ron Stringari, who was Atari's, was it vice president of marketing in the early 80s. Mm. And he had worked at Sears before then and was like involved in them getting the Pong unit and the 2600 there. He wasn't the lead on those projects, but he was there for them. He was the lead on getting the Intellivision licensed, like the Sears version of that, before he left for Atari. So he was able to speak on that. But it was very interesting. He got to talk to me a lot about how, you know, Atari, you know, planned their production runs and planned their marketing campaigns and how Sears got the exclusive games they did, you know, how retailers handled that stuff. So it was all very interesting. And on a similar note, you know, John Donatoni, who worked at Fairchild as their marketing guy for the Channel F, he shed a lot of light as to why that system had issues in the marketplace, like quality control problems. And he talked a fair bit about how they promoted it, and like they'd hire usually like housewives to work part-time because they wanted an extra bit of income, and they'd go out and they'd demonstrate the system at stores to people.
Oh,
and
they'd
advertise like, okay, it's the Fairchild like demonstration team, they're gonna come out and they're gonna explain to you how to work this video game, which is really smart, but it's like, it's not something I'd seen anything about anywhere. So that was really fascinating.
How cool would it be to actually find a woman who was on the Fairchild demonstration team?
Right? Like, I'm sure they're around. Like, if they were in their 20s or 30s at the time, I'm sure most of them are still alive. But
yeah, I would assume so.
I think my favorite one, and I haven't gotten to her game yet, was when I... It's my favorite because it took so damn long to track down, but I talked to Von Mai, who wrote Wabbit for the Atari 2600.
Oh, a video just came out on this somewhat recently. Were credited on.
Back in April, myself and Kate Willart, who's another video game history researcher, we've been trying to track her down for well over a year by that point. And we had a breakthrough. You know, someone on the Video Game History Foundation Discord realized they lived near like the National Archives for Texas, which is where all the records from Apollo games were, from their bankruptcy, were kept. And they were able to find out like some information for her that was contemporary from that time. We were able to use that to figure out where she was now. And she was a very fun interview, very nice woman. And super thrilled that people still cared about her game. And it was just very, like,
that's got
a very heartwarming story. Because we haven't gone in too deep on, like, the search for her. But for a while, when we were running with, like, the wrong name, because one of our coworkers misremembered her name, the best we could come up with was, oh, she might have been murdered in 1984. So the fact that she wasn't is much, much better.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that story went places. We haven't, like, dug into that particular story just because we have no idea, like, what's the best venue for that. Because it sure wasn't the Video Game History Foundation thing. But yeah, that was a wild, wild trip.
So cool.
And then, you know, some of the other interviews have been really good. Like, Bob Whitehead was really informative, and he's a really fun interview. Al Alcorn was really funny. Just great sense of humor on that guy. Larry Wagner, I got to talk to him. I think it was one of the first interviews he'd done in 40 years about the Atari.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, that one's actually... He actually gave me the thumbs up to publish that in the book that's coming out next year, because he wants to get his story regarding the Atari like more out there. So he's like, yeah, if you could put that in, go for it.
I feel like a lot. I mean, that's kind of like what Warren Davis said. I had him on the show a month or two ago. And it's just like a lot of these guys now are realizing, oh, people care about this thing that I did. It surprises me more when people like Warren are surprised by that. Cause like, you know, Qbert was huge, but like, it still is fun to see that people realize, oh, what I like, some goofy game I made, you know, back in the 70s or 80s still matters to people all these years later, especially like, you know, maybe stuff with like the Fairchild and like some of the other more obscure consoles that came out around this time, where it, like you said, the failures are almost more nothing. It's not indicative of the people that we're talking about, but just the failure of the console is almost more interesting than all the successes that you always hear, or the successes that you do hear about, excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could go on about all these interviews that I've really enjoyed, but there's been a lot of really good ones.
Well, then I would ask, what's a dream interview that you would love to get? What's someone you would love to speak to, just in general?
I would love to talk with Rick Maurer. He wrote, you know, the 2600 version of Space Invaders and the 2600 Maze Craze and Space Duel, the arcade game. The original version of it was from him. But before that, he worked at Fairchild, and he worked there for a few years on Channel F games. And, you know, he's been off the grid since 2008 or so. If you told me that he had passed away, I would believe it, because I have no idea where else he could be. But apparently, yeah, everyone I've talked to is like, yeah, he was extremely smart and just a great programmer. And I'd love to pick his brain about his time at Fairchild and his time at Atari. But I might have missed my window there.
It's crazy that even some of his old coworkers don't even know where he's at. I mean, I guess depending on how far removed someone is from the company, you might not keep in touch with everybody.
Yeah, back in what year was it? I think 2018, the Portland Retro Gaming Expo really wanted to get him out for the Space Invaders anniversary, and like they even reached out to me like, hey, do you know how to reach this guy? I'm like, I have as much information as you do. I have an email of him that for him that hasn't worked in 12 years. But yeah, I'd love to talk to him. I don't know if that's even possible, but maybe one day.
And on a completely unrelated note to any of this, I'm looking at just kind of completely changing gears, and just something I found interesting on your Twitter bio that I wanted to ask you about, but I didn't really have any good transition into asking this throughout our interview here. So by me calling out this bad transition, it makes it a good transition. Isn't that ironic? Sure. We're going to be, I wanted to, sure, I'm just, well, just at least pretend. I wanted to ask you, it says on your Twitter bio, you are a Splatterhouse world record holder.
Yes. I don't know that it's still the case, but, back in 2014, I got really into Splatterhouse, the TurboGrafx version. And a friend of mine, Caitlin Oliver, got the record for the arcade version. So I was like, you know, I could probably get the console one if you want to, like, give me some advice. So she's like, yeah, this stuff works on the arcade version. It might work on the console. It turns out it did work on the console as long as you, like, tweak things a little bit. So, yeah, I ended up setting a record for Splatterhouse. And I never bothered changing the Twitter bio from there because it was cool. I think.
Okay, so I mean,
it's been surpassed.
Sorry.
The guy who surpassed it's got a whole sordid story that's a little dark for this podcast, probably. But
okay.
So I choose not to acknowledge that he ever passed it up.
Didn't happen. History's written by the winners, right?
I mean, I saw his playthrough of it, and he was basically just like point scumming in a way that's not really allowed, but people at Twin Galaxies approved it, and the other people at the other scoreboards didn't, so I'm still the record holder last I checked for some of the other scoreboards, just not that one. You know, it's a really fun game. I think it's got a reputation for, you know, the gore more than the actual gameplay, but it's a fun game. I did get to mess with the arcade version a bit whenever I visit Chicago, because the Galloping Ghost has a cabinet, and as it turns out, yes, a lot of the strategies that you employ on the console do work on the arcade version. I'm not good enough at the arcade version to even be remotely competitive in it, but I can still pretty much finish the game.
Splatterhouse is just one of those games where I've heard so much about, but I've never really tried it out. Would you, like you said, it's fun, but do you think it holds up still? Would you recommend to other people to try it?
If you like, sort of like a proto brawler sort of thing. It's like side scrolling, you're punching things, but there's not a lot you can, there's no like planes to move around. But if you like that kind of game, like it's pretty fun. It's got, the aesthetic does a lot of work, I'll say that, but the game itself is perfectly sound. It's got great music. And
I don't know if I've listened to the game, soundtrack. I'll have to check that out.
Second game's okay. The third game's pretty interesting. It's like it's more like a traditional brawler, but it's time-based. And if you don't finish a stage within a certain amount of time, you get locked out of part of the good ending, which is a neat mechanic. And then the Famicom game is just like a platformer, and it's super good. So I definitely recommend the Famicom one. The other ones, depends on your tastes.
I was not expecting the Famicom one. Isn't that expensive now, too, the Famicom one?
Oh, I have no idea. I bought it back in 2005 when it was like $20.
All right, yeah, don't. I'm not gonna, I'm almost afraid to look it up then. all right. I only have a few more questions for you. To kind of wrap up my last, so I have one more question related to your YouTube channel, and then to end it off, I mentioned you off mic. I have a question from another podcast, and that I like to borrow from another podcast, and questions from Courtney. So my last question for you about your YouTube channel that I kind of want to use to wrap up and like give my listeners more of a incentive to go check it out. What's a direction you would like to take your channel in? And maybe speaking in like topics, are there any topics that you've really wanted to branch out into that you just have not been able to yet?
So I did already talk about the Bally. I do want to get into that more. So upcoming, you know, I've got in the chronological series, I'm coming up on 1982, which is a very interesting year, because that's when, you know, the market starts getting oversaturated and overheating. So that'll be really interesting. That's also when, you know, Pac-Man comes out, so I get to talk about Pac-Man and Frogger and Donkey Kong and all that fun stuff. So it's gonna be a lot of heavy hitters, because there's so many games that came out that year. It'll probably take me a few years to get through them all, but it'll keep me busy. I'd like to get into Odyssey stuff a little more.
Okay.
Like Odyssey 2 is really interesting. I really genuinely think that's a fun system. I had purposely not really touched it, because for a while I've had it as a like an incentive for my Patreon that I would eventually get to Odyssey 2 stuff. The problem with that has been that most of the people who worked on Odyssey 2 games don't really want to talk about it. I think I've talked to everyone who is willing to be interviewed for it. But it's a really cool machine. I might just, you know, drop that incentive or something, or change it and do something about the Odyssey 2, just because it's so cool. And, you know, I started doing these Intellivision videos, which Intellivision's another machine that I've always been really interested in ever since my grandma gave me one that she bought at a church sale for $10. It was 15, but she talked a woman down. She made sure to tell me.
$5.
$5. That was my grandma in a nutshell. But yeah, it's also a really interesting machine. Much easier to find people to talk about it. And I really enjoyed the first video I did about it. Like I said, I'm trying to put together the second one now, and I'm trying to set up interviews with the people who developed the games that are featuring into it. So that's a fun like side project as well.
I was going to ask, how did you determine which games to cover on your video series? Because how many games in total were released for Atari? Are you counting only Because from what I understand of the industry at the time, you didn't need a license from Atari to publish games for the Atari 2600. So I would have assumed there would have been hundreds and hundreds of games published for it, but maybe because not a lot of people knew how to do it back then, there aren't that many. Like
so the number I've seen most recently put the number of NTSC, like US releases, mm-hmm. or US and Canada, I guess, at about 420 something.
Okay.
Which is it's a lot, but it's a doable amount, I guess. Especially because starting with 1982, like halfway through the year, I've already got my episodes planned out for that. And mid-82 is when they start really deluging stores with games. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, you know what? At that point, I'm just going to have to cover multiple games per episode, or else I'm never going to live to get through this whole library.
I was going to say, I'm like, because I think, what are you in the, I forget. I saw like somewhat recently,
Finished video 61 in the 61. Series.
Okay, so I was even higher than, yeah, Breakout. Okay, yeah, Super Breakout. I was gonna say, I'm like, if you're only at 60, you just finished 61, or
yes, Super Breakout was number 60.
Yes,
I just finished working on the number 61 skeet shoot last night, and so that's going up in a week. And yeah, so far I've combined two games into one, and that was the Checkers episode, just because they came out like a month apart from each other, and they're both Checkers. So it's like, well, I'm not going to go over the exact same information about Checkers twice. I'm just going to do this.
Or you could have taken this as an opportunity and been the only YouTube channel to devote two whole videos to effectively the same Checkers game.
Yeah, I could have done that. I really missed opportunity there.
So what a missed opportunity. My last one more follow up question with that, I should say, are you going to cover the infamous Atari porn games?
Yes. So I have those scheduled to be one video, because I don't have to touch that topic more than once.
I don't blame you.
But yes, I can actually bring up the exact episode number it's scheduled to.
If it's not episode 69, you've done a disservice to everybody.
Unfortunately, episode 69 is Grand Prix, which is not as interesting.
No, it's all, unfortunately, you're at the whims of time. So, you know, if it doesn't line up with the release schedule, you're kind of out of luck with that one.
Yeah, pretty much. OK, so those are episode 113. So I've got a bit of a ways to go, but they'll get there eventually, I assume.
It's interesting. You're talking about you being interested in the Intellivision. I mentioned to you off mic, I did that shorter like history of RTS series. A lot of early RTS games are on the Intellivision. Mm-hmm. I think Utopia is, it's not really an RTS, but it's kind of like a predecessor to the RTS genre. There was also I'm gonna be so mad right now, I don't remember the name of the games I covered on it.
I just played one that called Sea Battle over the weekend. Yes, with a
friend of mine. That was one of them. Yeah.
And that's actually a lot more fun than I was expecting it to be. Like, I've had it sitting on my shelf for little years because I could never get anyone to play it with me. Mm-hmm. But I have a friend here who is game for pretty much any old video game I ask him to help me record footage for. So we try that out, and turns out pretty good.
I put Naval Battle. I think it's the same thing. And War of Nerves was another one.
That's an Odyssey 2 game.
I think you're right. Yeah. Good. God damn, you have a good memory. Yeah, War of Nerves. that surprised me, just because it was like kind of RTS-esque, where you were a general and you had full control of the general, but you had three other soldiers that were kind of doing their own thing. So you had to. You could only control the general, but by controlling the general, you could kind of do rudimentary, like you could influence the direction that your soldiers would go. So it's like kind of RTS, kind of not at all. The battle all takes place on the screen, but it's not really, because you don't build it. I went into it on my episode, but I was surprised by that, but I was more surprised by Utopia, just the amount of detail. Like, there's so many mechanics happening in that game. especially for an Intellivision, for a game from that era, not on a PC or something. It's really impressive what they were able to do with Utopia.
Yeah, it's something that struck me when I was talking with Frank Cifaldi and Kelsey Lewin for the Video Game History Hour podcast on the Intellivision they had me on for. So I was talking to them, it struck me, I'm like, yeah, this was the first home game console that was designed to be for home games, like games you could not experience in the arcade. Because if you look at, the Atari console and the Channel F and the, I guess less so the Studio 2, but that's a whole other can of worms. But you look at these other systems and they're trying to make very arcade oriented experiences. Like they're very pick up and play sort of games, or they're, educational things no one cares about. But the Intellivision, like, you had these really complex baseball games and football and basketball and sports games in general that would run like an actual game amount of time, and tried to bring all the mechanics of the actual sports to you. And you had stuff like Utopia and Sea Battle that were a lot more in depth, or Armor Battle, like one of the first games that came out on the machine, that are just, they're not the kinds of experiences you could get on other systems, because the system with the Intellivision was built that way. It was built to be able to do these kinds of things, and it was part of the whole like reasoning for developing it in the first place. So I find that's one of the reasons that the Intellivision is so interesting, because it is kind of the first stab at what you might consider, home game consoles and home video games. I guess, and that and Superman.
I didn't even think about that. I remember in doing some research for my RTS series, I remember reading that. I didn't include it on the episode because it wasn't really like, it didn't really fit in with the focus of the episode that I was doing, but I remember reading about that. And the dude who made Utopia, Don Daglow, has been in the games industry for a long time. He's been, I was curious, like, what was his last like credit, according to Moby Games, at the very least. Like, he was working pretty actively up until like the early 2000s. And then he slowed down his production, but his last game, he worked on a Nancy Drew game. For a mobile Nancy Drew game from 2011. So I maybe there's other stuff now, but I think he works more like as a type of, not influence, like a advisory consultant. Type of role. A consultant, that's the word I can think. Yeah, advisory consultant type of role.
I can see that. Yeah, I know he donated all of his papers to the Strong Museum of Play up in
that's awesome.
Rochester. I haven't delved into them because when I visited, I was only there for like a day, but probably some really interesting tidbits up there. Was it Kate Willard? I think she got to go sift through his papers. She was not looking at his Intellivision stuff specifically, but apparently it was quite informative.
I should eventually try to go, because I can't go. I have a kid now. God damn it.
But it's a museum of play. You take the kid to the museum, and then you're
right. I could just
do the library
you
stuff.
You babysit my child. I'm going to go bury myself in papers.
Here's a sock full of quarters, kid. Go play the arcade games.
Don't hit anybody with it. Or actually, no. It's simultaneously a self defense weapon and also a play, something to play with.
Exactly.
Oh my god. So I want to start wrapping this up. So. I said before, I have two questions I like to close out on. So I'm a huge fan of Alan Alda's podcast called Clear and Vivid, which, if you haven't listened to it, by the way, highly recommend it. But he ends all of his episodes with seven quick questions, which don't really invite seven quick answers, but it's meant to be just like whatever pops into your head. So my question for you is, I'm not going to ask all seven. You'd be here for a while. What book changed your life?
That's a good question. I feel like it would be a Terry Pratchett book.
Okay.
Although it's hard to nail down specifically which one. Because I remember I read Soul Music first, and I mean, that's a really good one, but it's not the one that really affected me. And then I just sort of voraciously delved through a lot of the other ones. I think it might actually be, what's it called? Going Postal.
Okay. Okay. By Terry Pratchett.
Yeah, the one where the, like, a con man gets put in charge of the postal service, and it's like all he has to clean it up and make it work right again. And, you know, he's competing against modern technology, you know, quote unquote, because it's the Discworld. But just, it's, I don't know, that book stuck with me. You know, just the way that it frames, you know, public service, and like an obligation to your community, if you really want to consider it that, in his case. Because I feel like most of my career, my day job career, has been focused on that kind of stuff. Like, I worked at a library for a long time, and then I worked in newspapers, for like local newspapers, covering, you know, local news. And now I work like in another public service job. So, you know, I think that's cool. It's influenced my work a lot, or my career a lot, and therefore, you know, what I've done over the years.
I am not the biggest reader, but I've never read a Terry Pratchett book. I really like sci-fi and like fantasy types of books, and I've heard nothing but good things about his writing. If you were to recommend a book to me to try out to start, because I need to set aside some time for it, just because I like a chapter a night. That's all I got to do. 10 minutes even. 30 minutes a night. I just got to like pick a book and then read 30 minutes a night. What book would you recommend of his that I should try out?
So I would not recommend the first Discworld book, because the very first ones are they're like fantasy parodies. Like, he's just parodying the you know, the tropes of the fantasy genre, but they get really good once he starts using them as a vehicle to satirize you know, just pop, like, modern culture, and that sort of thing, particularly in Britain, because he was a British person. And he has got like a lot of sub series. I think Guards might be a good starting point, just because that's the first one in his sub-series about the Ankh-Morpork City Watch. And that's probably the most prolific series he did, just because he really liked those characters, and he really liked satirizing modern culture through them.
It's called The Guards?
Yes. And beyond that, Going Postal is really good. The Truth is pretty fun. It's like a standalone one. And Monstrous Regiment, which is another standalone one. And that one it's kind of about jingoism and kind of about sexism in the military. Spoiler alert, it basically everyone fighting in a war is a woman, even though women aren't supposed to be able to fight. Like, they're not allowed in military service, but they all signed up anyway, and it turns out they were all women. So that was a fun book. It's a good read.
I will have to check.
And, you know, the holiday season's coming up. There's always Hogfather, which Hogfather is like it's about the it's like their Santa Claus equivalent, the Hogfather.
Okay.
And it's a really interesting, like the central premises of it, like, how do you kill a legendary figure, and like, in turn, how do you protect a legendary figure from someone trying to murder it?
So does it posit that like the Hogfather or their version of Santa Claus is actually real, or is it like killing the concept of like a legendary figure?
Yes, I can say yes to both of those. In fact, that actually gives me another good recommendation from that book series, Small Gods. It's a standalone book. It's one that it's funny, but it's not like as funny as some of his other stuff, but it's like his treatise on religions and gods. Mm. And it's a really interesting one.
I'd be curious about that. All right. My last question for you is questions from Courtney. Questions from Courtney. Bum, ba, da, bum, 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 bum. So for questions from Courtney this time, if you found a genie in a lamp, what are your three wishes?
Oh, man. So I think first off, we need the passenger pigeon back. I want the skies to be darkened with the clouds of birds.
Every time a tweet gets sent, a real bird has to send the message somewhere.
Exactly. Just give me millions of these birds flying overhead.
We would solve all the over. The sky would be blotted out with birds. We wouldn't have to worry about overheating ever. It's a solution to global warming, right?
Yeah, I feel like a lot of my wishes would probably be environmentally related, just because that's actually again, my day job is a science writer, so that's near and dear to my heart. Well, I would also have to. Oh man, that is a tough one. Is this a genie? Is this like a monkey's paw genie where they're gonna screw me over somehow, or is it?
Let's go with they're genuine. They're not gonna play a trick on you in this one. It's the Disney's genie who's actually very nice and genial.
Okay. Unless he's trying to trick Jafar into doing something.
Exactly. So unless you're Jafar, you're good.
Okay, well, that's fine. So yeah, I would probably. I feel like I would need to. Oh, there's a bug in here. Wow, that's a tough question. It's a tougher question than it should be. I would also request the return of PB Crisps, because I love those snack crackers, and I lament their loss every day.
And your third would be more wishes.
No, just, you know, let's... Can we set something up here with the genie to, like, get some clean energy going so we, you
know, there we can go.
Stabilize everything?
That'd I'm cool. with you on that. I am with you. I wanted to do a charity stream this year for an environmental charity, because I always see all the big video game speedrunning stuff is always, not that I'm not a speedrunner, but and I was going to try to organize something like that, but it always goes to like charities that are important nonetheless, but I really feel like the environmental charities are the ones that I'm like, the others won't exist without this, we need to get this shit taken care of. So I'm like, I was trying to set something up for November, and then just everything kind of fell apart. Maybe, who knows? Maybe I'll just do something small. I had this big idea, but I might have to just pare it down. So we'll see. We'll see. But I'm with you on that. So, okay, let's wrap this up completely by having you tell my listeners where they can find you online and anything else you'd like to promote.
Yeah, sure. So I'm on Twitter at Ubersaurus. That is very old handle that's just stuck from the days where you could just change your handle all the time. That was the one that just didn't get changed, so that's that. I'm on YouTube under Atari Archive. I'm also on Patreon under Atari Archive, and I've got a website that I don't update very frequently because I've been very busy, called atariarchive.org. No S at the end. That's a different website that I didn't realize existed until I already signed up that domain. So very confusing.
Should I be afraid to go to that other website?
No, the other website's great. It's just okay. Not mine. yeah, like I mentioned earlier, I've got a book that should be coming out a couple of months after this podcast goes out. So keep an eye out for that. I'm sure I'll be shilling it immensely once it's available.
I'll have to have you back on for maybe something more specific instead of an interview, and you can promote it then too.
Yeah, there we go.
As usual for me, you can find... Oh, actually, I'm sorry. Before I do my spiel, your Patreon as well. You have a Patreon.
Yes. It's under Atari Archive.
So yeah, please go support Kevin over there, patreon.com/AtariArchive. As for me, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. If you want to email me, you can email me stillloadingcontact@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, you can do so in a number of ways. You can give it a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use, because that helps more people find the show and it makes me feel warm and fuzzy, and I like feeling warm and fuzzy. And if you want to support the show monetarily, you can go to patreon.com/stillloadingpod. For $1 a month, you'll get all the episodes a couple days earlier at a higher bitrate, as well as access to a patron exclusive Discord. For $4 a month, you'll get all of that plus 2 bonus mini episodes. And then for $5 a month, you'll get everything I mentioned before, plus access to Still Bonding, the Still Loading sister podcast where my friend Eric and I go through every single James Bond movie and talk about the zaniness that is that franchise. So if that interests you and you want to hear us go ramble on about it, at the time this episode will come out, From Russia with Love will have released already, so you'll be looking for, there'll already be 2 episodes out for that, plus over 20 plus bonus episodes. So patreon.com/stillowningpod. But if money is tight, please consider going to the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of kids receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So if you want to support them, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. And that will do it for this episode of Still Loading. Kevin, thank you once again for joining me, man. I had a lot of fun. Audience won't hear a lot of this stuff, but thank you for putting up with all my stumblings and bumblings. I was a little more tongue-tied, marble mouth than I normally am. So thank you for joining me for this episode.
Hey, you know, we're all a bit punchy out here in Dadland. Dadland. Oh, God. Actually, your bit-by-bit thing reminds me, one of the articles I wrote as a local paper person was a follow-up to an article we ran back in the 80s about a group that would do exactly that. Like, they'd like contact all these game companies to get consoles and cartridges together, and they'd donate them to the local children's hospitals. And one of the members still lived in the area, and I did a follow-up with him, like, can you tell me about thing you used to do, and how did that like wind down? It was pretty cool.
That's really cool. Yeah. The Bit by Bit crew is actually, I worked with, we were talking about old jobs. I used to work at a grocery store. A coworker of mine went off to college. Now he's, he's got a fancier job than I do, but him and his college buddies, who they all met online playing games together, were like, well, this was super beneficial to us. This might be helpful for kids who are stuck in like hospice or stuck in hospital beds or whatnot. So they donate the consoles to the hospitals themselves so it can be passed along to kids to play games while they're just got nothing else going on. So I thought that was a really cool thing, and it was cool that a friend of mine helped start it. So I figured, I don't like listeners, this, whenever I give a shout out to them, there's like, they're obviously, it'd be really shitty of me to take money for that, but like, so just to be fully clear, it should have been obvious, but it should be obvious. I don't get paid for that, but two, I just, it's a cool thing. So I always want to shout them out because they're a smaller charity. So I want to raise as much awareness of them as I can. So, but that will do it for this episode of Still Loading. Thank you all for listening, and I will see you all next time.
Un poisson, s'il vous plaît. We'll be right back. s'il vous plaît.